Bills.
Yo, yo, what's up, Kelly? What's happening?
How are you, man? Good to see you.
We're on the last day of 46 today, so we are celebrating. We are enjoying a good family weekend. Julie and I got a double date night tomorrow night and going to the Charlotte FC game.
Nice.
We've got golf at 7 a.m. on Sunday morning. We got some Masters. We got plenty of kid time. Got a little festival we're going to tonight. So we got a loaded schedule with people that I love to be around doing stuff I love. So is it an ego weekend? Maybe they've arranged it so that it's very appreciative of me. So I can accept that. I feel it's a pretty good setup for this weekend, man. So I'm pretty excited. You caught me at a good time.
That's good. You sound like you have a good late 40s Eve scheduled. That's
a late. Yeah. Just compare a late 40s Eve schedule to a late 20s Eve birthday weekend. This is pre-kids. This is pre-Julie. It was probably a late night. It was probably at a sports bar. It was probably with bar games. Probably feeling rough in the morning. Probably waking up and sleeping in on Sunday until like noon and getting a Jersey Mike sub.
Right.
You know?
Yes. So the University of Illinois, their Sweet 16 game tipped off at 9:40 p.m. local time. And I was talking to somebody at 3 in the afternoon. I was at a coffee shop and I was getting coffee so that I could stay up for the game. And they're like, oh, so you're doing like 47-year-old pre-gaming. I'm like, yes. Yeah. It's switched from alcohol to caffeine. Correct.
47. Yo, so you're already at 47 right now.
I'll be 48 in December.
Yeah.
Just a little ahead of you. It's been a good year, man. I think there's good things in store for you.
Oh, well, what's your advice from someone who's already sitting on that ledge of 47? Any tip that you might offer someone who's about to turn 47?
Oh, man, love your limitations. I did make it, thanks to Front Row Dads and Roman's podcast and some connections in Front Row Dads, I made the call at the beginning of the year to quit drinking alcohol.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's going to last forever. I'm taking it 1 month at a time. So that's been interesting to go through like all these events where since I was 21, I'd have plenty to drink during them and then to not have it. And that's been good. That's been a good piece of 47. I turned 47 right before the beginning of the year. So
yeah.
But I'd say, man, the thing I've been doing is I've been asking my 21-year-old self if he'd be happy with my life right now. And his answer is like, are you freaking crazy? You got it made. Relax, enjoy yourself. So that's where I'm at. Happy birthday, man. I'm glad I got to connect with you at this time.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Appreciate it.
How's the book? Like, what's post-book release?
Yes.
Everybody starts to ignore you again. It's a terrible feel. Like, how are you doing with the post-book release?
I'm glad you asked because I have a different lens on this.
Good. Okay.
Because my expectations in the very beginning, when we even started to write the book, were so low and so not tied to results. I simply wanted to check something off. Like my ego tells me from a very young age, you are born to be an author. This is going to be something to check off your dreams list.
Yeah, right.
So I thought that forever. And then as life goes on, certain metrics or certain key things are met. And now it's not about just checking it off anymore. Now it's about impact. So my version of success for the book is I write a book, publish it. Someone calls, messages, texts me, has a conversation with me. We share some emotion around how this has impacted them. That is the program for success for me. That was the result that I was seeking. And that's still kind of intangible. That happened a number of times so far. I feel it's already been successful. So anything from here is just an extra cherry on top.
Yep. You're dialed in. That's awesome.
I think that's how I feel about it now. Would that have been the way when I was 28? If we had written this, first of all, it would have been a different book. The character still would have been a jerk. Most people would say, but it's a different game now because once you account for the things you think you want in your 20s and you are fortunate to have some of those things in your 40s, it's like, what's the game about now? And now, to me, it's all about being present and just seeing these things that happen every day, these little miracles, and being really cognizant of, I really enjoyed our breakfast this morning at the family table where we got out a big search and find book with like Waldo and we found a bunch of people with random stuff on the continent of South America. I mean, that was it.
Well, I never thought about it like this, but so in True Companions, I presented some research that shows that, you know, I mean, like when we start out in life, we're all about our people. We're literally dependent upon them. Okay. And then we arc through this like ambitious, self-establishing, ego-building sort of trajectory. But as you get closer to the end of your life, your priorities shift back to your people. But for most people, that doesn't happen until the end of life starts to feel relatively imminent. It's like that reality is what shifts their mindset. It's just like dawning on me as you say that, but I feel like front row dads, ironically, is like aging us prematurely in a sense that it's like helping us get back to the mindset about what really matters decades before most people will eventually return to it, if that makes any sense.
I completely agree through the lens you shared that in that sense, it is aging us. And maybe a different question could be, how might we learn to get to a place or model in a place, if it's even possible, so that this middle time in life where it goes from all family to self, finding that self, and then comes back to family, how do we shorten that time? Or in an ideal setting, possibly, how do we remove that so that it's all about family the whole time? It's all about community the whole time, possibly.
Right. Yeah. Or somehow they intermingle instead of being such distinct periods of life. Because I know you're still, you're doing amazing things in the world.
I hope so.
You haven't given up on impact outside of the home.
Right? Yeah.
I just think to hear you talk about like what's satisfying you at this point is really inspiring, man.
Well, I come back to you because as you know, where'd my copy go? Here it is. I've always got a few copies with me. I carry these books with me everywhere. I've always got this little backpack that I got from the Front Row Dad's Retreat. I always carry 5 copies in there. They're signed. I give them out to people at coffee shops. I always leave one everywhere I go. Very quietly just putting the book out there. You're on the cover. I wanted to put you on the cover simply because you're my favorite author. I've gotten so much value from Lovable. I got it gifted to me by a couple different people in the community. So I've got 3 copies of it on the shelf. And of course, you gifted us with The Unhiding of Elijah Campbell. Love that. I cried. Reading the opening page was a crier for me. Wow. So I wanted to honor you by putting you on there. And I was having a conversation on the podcast yesterday. Was it yesterday? I had 3 people on. It was the first guest yesterday who they said that they picked up the book and they said, your quote from the back of the cover, optimism can be one of the most powerful mindset, but it can also become our biggest blind spot if we use it to avoid deep realities of life. And they led my podcast episode with your quote on the book. So that was kind of cool. Wow. So yeah,
I thought you did such a brilliant job of threading that needle in the story. You showed it to us instead of telling it to us, which is part of the craft of being a fiction writer, but just showing how he walked on such a Patrick, right? Am I remembering that right?
Yeah,
I read it many months ago, in its earliest version. So Patrick walked such a fine line of tipping that optimism in the direction of enhancing his life versus sort of avoiding his life. And I thought he portrayed that brilliantly.
Thank you. Avoiding life. That's a good frame for it, because if you only read it through this lens, that's interesting because it's only this lens that we tell the story. So you only see this version of the person that talks themselves about their stuff, right? So it may appear that he's avoiding, and in what his reality, he wasn't avoiding anything. He was living life fully and he didn't understand why everyone else couldn't change they were avoiding.
That's right. Well, and that's the brilliance of the writing is that, we were only in the first person even. We were sort of like getting to sort of be a window into his self-deception. We knew more than he did, which is not an easy thing to portray. So I thought that was really well done.
Cool. Well, to hear that from you is great feedback and it makes you smile and I appreciate it.
Yeah, you bet.
I have a different question for those of us who might be watching on YouTube right now. I see in your background looks different than the last time I saw you. You've got The Unhiding of Elijah Campbell blown up over there. It looks like a giant canvas print over there. What is that? Because I love
it's closer to the camera.
I want one. I want to do that for my book too. Is that a Canva or
I think it's a Canvas Pop. I use Canvas Pop. I'm not getting an affiliate fee for mentioning them. They're a class act, canvaspop.com. So I sent all my book covers into canvaspop.com, and a week later I got a printed canvas of each one. Same for my Substack, which is over here, Humaning. Okay. That's the logo for my Substack where I'm currently doing all my writing. And so, it's a way of saying this is what I'm putting out in the world.
Awesome. Well, anyone that listens to this show, they will remember the episode that we recorded some time ago, and they know that I talk about you somewhat frequently. And so hearing you speak about the H, can you go a little bit deeper on that? Because I don't have a whole lot of experience with Substack. So when you say the word Substack, I feel like there's some younger generation of people that are deep into it, or some authors that are deep into it. But frankly, I've never been to it, so I don't even know what you're talking about. So can you share a little bit about what is Substack? What's the H behind you? What does that mean?
I was in exactly the same position as you on the first week of 2023. The same afternoon, I spoke to my agent and a good friend who's in the publishing industry. And I told both of them that I sort of wanted to form my next book, my next nonfiction book. I wanted to form it with my readers, getting their feedback and getting their reactions and crowdsourcing some of the wisdom for the book. And at the time, I was writing and blogging entirely still on my own website. And both of them said, have you thought about Substack for that? Great platform for building community for writers and serializing content. So I went over to Substack, started digging around, and it's like, wow, it's a really cool platform. I mean, it's diversifying in terms of its content. It hosts podcasts now, it hosts audio, but it started out as a longer form written content platform for writers. And it's built so that you can establish an inner circle of a paid community on it, which is something that I'd been wanting to do for a while. I transferred basically my 14,000 email subscribers over to Substack. I write once a week there. Everybody gets a free weekly writing on Substack. I call it Humaning is the name of my Substack.
Okay.
And my tagline is helping kind people navigate the complexities of human connection. Because one of the things I've discovered about the community that sort of gathers around my writing is that it's really kind people, thoughtful people who are just trying their best to be the best human beings they can be in really complicated life situations. So we are navigating the complexities of human connection together there. And free subscribers get a weekly reading, and then paid subscribers get a monthly Zoom community call with me, as well as access to our relationship lab where I provide customized feedback on relationship issues that they're having. So it's a really cool spot right now. And I think you're going to hear more about Substack in the next 5 years.
Oh, I know I am, because one of the 47th birthday gifts that I'm graciously receiving right now is an invitation to go and look at your community on Substack and to learn about it. So this is super cool, man. So I'm going to go.
Excellent.
Where exactly do I go? I just go to Substack and then type in Humaning Dr. Kelly Flanagan, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's actually, you could do that. Just substack.com and then search me, Humaning Dr. Kelly Flanagan, or you can go to drkellyflanagan.substack.com.
Ah.
So drkellyflanagan.substack.com. Yep.
Got it. I've got a smile on my face because every time I say your name, I think, I hope you know I'm talking to you, not your wife.
I know, right? Kelly and Kelly. If you go to my about page on Substack, you'll see me mention that I'm married to Kelly Flanagan, also spelled the exact same way, also with a PhD in clinical psychology. And we wreak havoc at airport security. I mean, they just do not. When we fly, they're sure we're up to something. And we're not. But every time we get asked about it.
I bet.
Yeah.
I bet. Well, I remember that part of the buildup for the book was this place that I felt, is anybody going to read this? Is anybody going to find value from this? Because it's just, it's creative nonfiction. Is anybody going to actually find this to be of value? Because to me, it's me on a page. So I feel like there's this vulnerability openness that I'm putting this out there. I'm wondering, with Lovable, which was the first book that I read of yours, and that really connected with me in the heart. I'm curious how that or any of your books, really, how you felt about putting yourself and putting your thoughts on paper. Was there ever in this moment of imposter syndrome, or this moment of, I just wonder if this is going to connect with anybody? How did you go through that when you were getting started, Kelly?
Yeah. Currently, my posts go out every Wednesday morning at 5 a.m. And I wake up at 5:30 a.m. every morning. And on Wednesdays, I almost inevitably think, what did you do? it has never really gone away, that sense of vulnerability that comes. If I don't have that sense of vulnerability when I publish something, whether it's a book or a post, I wonder if I've gotten honest enough, been true enough in what I'm saying. And maybe it was just too easy, too vanilla, too safe. For me, writing is not a way of telling you about the answers I've sorted out, but it's my way of sorting out the answers. I'll give you an example. My son and I are spreading mulch last Saturday. He's 16 years old. And I'm actually having the thought as I'm watching him do it that he's not on his phone. This is really cool. Like, it's hours of spreading. He seems happy. Like, this is not a typical experience for teenagers these days to just be with themselves and happy. And he brings a wheelbarrow full over to me. He says, Dad, being a lifeguard has really helped me be alone with my thoughts. And I thought, man, that is an essential and endangered skill in 2024, especially for young kids, is to be alone with their thoughts. Like all of a sudden, that's a blog post. That's going to be a post on Substack. I don't know when, but not because I know exactly why that felt meaningful to me, but because I need to figure it out. I need to write it out to figure out why it's important to me. And in that, I'm going to find some stuff that's vulnerable. And if I don't include that, then I'm probably staying too safe. So every Wednesday morning at 5:30, I wake up like, oh, what did I do? Lovable felt particularly vulnerable. I think that's the case for a lot of people with their first work, because they're oftentimes putting their whole story into that first work. There's sort of a joke that you get your whole life to write your first book, and then you've got 2 years to write your next one. And so you're putting a lot of vulnerability into that first book. It felt very, very exposing. Again, like I really appreciated what you said. When I get that first comment on a post, someone says this was helpful, it's like, okay, mission accomplished. And with Lovable, I've certainly had that experience over and over again through the years where somebody tells me what an impact it's made on their life. And it's like, okay, the vulnerability is worth it. I don't know that it makes the vulnerability go away, but it certainly validates it and it validates its purpose. So that's where I sort of stand with it right now. I've given up on eliminating the vulnerability and just want to live into it and let that be part of the process. Yeah.
I wonder if the mission is to eliminate the vulnerability, then I think we may be off base. The mission is to impact others' lives, or the mission is to go through the process and sort out my own stuff. And transparently, others might learn how to sort theirs. But if the mission is to remove vulnerability, then I think we got the wrong mission. So I'm glad you say this. I'm just kind of sorting out my own out loud.
Yeah. Well, so like right now, the nonfiction book that I started working on Substack and has been evolving quickly. Currently, the working title is Open-Hearted, Turning Conflict into Connection with a Single Choice. I've been struggling. It's a three-part book. The first part revolves around being able to see that moment your heart starts to close, oftentimes in relationships, but can happen at any point. But being able to really slow down and see the moment your heart starts to close. The second part of the book is about really owning your response, understanding what's underneath the hood of that response inside of you. So it's sort of an emotional intelligence phase of it. And then the third phase is then how to show back up to your people and your relationships with what you've learned in that process. I've really been struggling to bring the third part of the book together. I think the reality is that that's because that's what I'm needing to learn from this book. Is as I sort out the third part of that book, I'm going to be discovering my blind spots. I'm going to be discovering my weaknesses. I'm going to be discovering the places I need to grow. And so that third part of the book is both the most vulnerable part, but also it's going to be the most rewarding part. And it'll probably be the part that helps people the most, because it's probably the place that few of us go. So I'm excited about that. It's challenging, but that's what the creative process feels like for me, is it feels like a process of self-discovery that I can sort of pass on to other people.
That's such a great frame, the process of self-discovery that I can pass on to other people. And yes, I'm on the edge of my seat with these three phases, because the third one, the moment that your heart starts to close, the second one, understanding the response in you, and then the third, how to show back up. Already a cliffhanger. I'm already on the edge of my seat here. How do you show back up? Because if anyone just heard you say those three things or heard me repeat those three things, then that stuck with me instantly. And I know exactly where in my life at this moment in multiple relationships where that shows up. And I'm also working through how to show back up. So, yeah.
Well, I think part of it is, as it's starting to come into focus for me is that, actually currently the third part of the book is titled Simplify Your Love. Because I think a big part of relationships is that we overcomplicate them. We've got so many KPIs. We're not quite sure which one's the most important one. And we're trying to pour our energies into all these different ways of improving the relationship. And so one of the concepts there is that we aren't responsible for helping our people to feel happy, but we are responsible for helping our people to feel safe. And the idea there is that happiness is ultimately an inside job. Any one of us probably can relate to that. You try to make a person happy and it's going to be ultimately up to them to be happy or not. Teenagers will force you to face that reality. But safety is not an inside job. Safety depends upon your inner state plus your outer environment. Is the environment safe for you to be in? And so one of the things I focus on in that section is that when we become a companion, we also become a context for somebody. We become the environment now in which they're living. And so we do have something to contribute to whether or not their life is a life that feels safe insecure. So there's sort of this interdependence to it. Yes, they're responsible to some extent for their sense of inner safety, but we are now the context in which they get to experience a sense of outer safety. And the reality is when our hearts are closing all the time and we're reacting and defending and attacking, we're not a safe space for our people, right? And so that third part is about how we can show up as a safer space for our people. At least right now, that's what I think that piece is really about.
When the student is ready, the teacher appears, and you just shared some words that are just different than the words I thought in my mind when I was going through a scenario recently. So this is exactly what I needed to hear at the right time. Our job is to help others to feel safe. It's not to help them feel happy. That's an inside job. So I love the helping them feel safe. And I can translate that into how my actions recently have not helped a couple of particular people feel safe. Maybe more on the opposite of safety is judgment. And right. I've helped people to feel judged, which may not be the long-term equation for safety, is to help them feel judged.
Well, and that's in that second piece, the owning of your response is really beginning to recognize that when you're judging somebody, it's because you don't feel safe. There's some experience in you that you're wrestling with and needing to protect against. And so hopefully by the time we're showing back up to our people, we've got a better grasp on what's going on in that moment, where we're judging, where we're trying to control, where we're being critical, where we're hiding and distancing and withdrawing. Like, what is all that stuff about, and how can we understand it so that we can show up and actually like stay in the saddle with our people when things get tough? That's the hope by the time we reach that point.
Yeah, but let's just say this. I'll give you an example here. Let's just say that you and I, we go to the next Front Row Dads event. You know, we're sitting there, we have a good time, and you share with me today that you're taking a month of time just experimenting with alcohol free. And same for me. I've been alcohol free since the marathon. So it's been a few months, committed to this year alcohol free. And let's just say that you reach for a beer and you've told me that you like to be alcohol free. So I feel it might be my responsibility as your friend to remind you of that, try to hold you accountable to something you said you wanted to do.
Yeah.
How might I do that in a way that doesn't make you feel judged? Because in my mind, I am holding you accountable to something you said you wanted. And I am a rule follower when it comes to these discipline things. So I may come off a little bit aggressive or a little bit direct, and that may not make you feel safe. I think the safety is in that you can count on me to follow through on the things that we both want.
It's such a great question. So first of all, yes, please do hold me accountable, because what I've done is at the beginning of each month this year, I'm taking it month by month. At the beginning of January, I said, I'm going to have a dry January. I looked at February on February 1. I said, I'm going to stay sober in February. At the beginning of April, I looked at it and I said, oh, there's a Front Row Dads retreat in Florida in April. That's something I want to stay sober during. And I ultimately decided, yes, so I re-upped for April. So yes, please hold me accountable. I'm making no guarantees about May. I haven't thought about May yet. In AA, they say one day at a time. I'm just taking it one month at a time. But yeah, please hold me accountable. And I think that what jumps out at me about what you said is that phrase, it's such a powerful phrase, make you feel judged. So the reality is you can't make me feel judged. My feelings are my feelings. And in this part of the book, I think what we're going to get in, I call it the interdependence principle of open-heartedness. So there's codependence, there's independence, and then there's interdependence. So codependence is when essentially, well, one way of saying independent codependence would be, hey, your stuff is my stuff and my stuff is your stuff. We're sort of, I disappear into you. Your emotions are my emotions and my emotions create your emotions. There's not a lot of differentiation. I disappear into you. Independence is I distance myself from you. Hey, your stuff is your stuff. You got to deal with that. I have nothing to do with that. Go take care of yourself. That's independence. Interdependence is more a dance with each other where we say, hey, your stuff is our stuff. Yes, you have a responsibility to take care of your own inner world, but I'm the context in which your inner world is happening now. So I can rub up against it. I can sort of aggravate it. I can trigger it. And I want to take responsibilities for the ways that I'm doing that. So you tell me in the Florida Keys, hey, are you sure you want to have that? I'm trying to think of what my favorite beer would be. A pseudo Sue. Oh, gosh, I hope they don't have pseudo Sue in them.
I thought White Claw for a second there, Kelly.
Oh, no, I'm a hazy IPA okay. guy. So you tell me that. And if I start to say you've made me feel judged, in open-hearted companionship, we can both have a conversation about how much of that do I own? How much of that do you own? How much of that is I was going to feel judged if anybody called me out on that because I'm really sensitive about that right now. And how much of that was, yeah, I could have probably approached that a little bit differently. I was sort of judging you. I thought you were better than that. Okay. Well, then I was judging you, not really supporting you. Okay. Yeah, I could take some ownership of that. That's the interdependence. And there's a lot of safety in that when two people can say, what parts of this can we own together? That's a big piece of that, of understanding that we're a context for someone else, but we're not the cause of their inner life. We're just the context for it.
Well, I do not intend to see you in Florida and bring a hazy IPA just to test this theory.
That would be so... That...
I want you to feel safe here. I want to put this right here next to us. Yeah,
thank you. Right. That's so funny.
You know, it makes me wonder that as an author, part of the gift you bring to the world, and especially you bring to the world, is you are, I would say, vulnerable enough to share how you sort things out. And that's of incredible value from people that respect you and love you to hear that you sort out stuff too, that you're not in the ivory tower, like in your castle, like you, drawbridge is down, you're out, you're sharing it.
Yeah.
That's inspirational for me and for, I'm sure, for our listeners and for your audience that you share.
I think that's one thing that's inspirational about your book is that you've been pretty open about. Everyone wonders when someone writes fiction, how much of the protagonist is actually the author and how much isn't. And sometimes it's a little bit of both, but you've been really out there with like, my experience influenced this protagonist story, reflects me in a lot of ways, which again, I think that makes it a powerful story for people. And yeah, I guess I would just say, I don't know about your experience, but like the authors that have influenced me the most are the ones who write from a sense of personal vulnerability, always with an eye not toward just being self-expressive or self-disclosing for the sake of self-disclosure, but like, hey, I want to tell you about what it's like to be human inside my skin. And I hope that's going to help you to be human inside your skin. Henry Nouwen is one of my favorite authors. And he always says the most personal is the most universal. So if you want to get to something that relates to everybody, get all the way to the center of your own experience. That's sort of been my ethos of writing and creating has been, if you can get to the center of it, to the root of it, you're probably going to touch on something that most people also experience at the center of their humanity. And it'll be more universal that way.
Yeah. Writing that down. I like that. Most personal is the most universal. That really connects. What has Henry written? I don't know him yet. So I'm curious. I might pick up some of his stuff.
He's definitely more for someone from the Christian tradition. He was a Catholic priest. Fascinating story, though. I mean, that really resonates with Patrick's story. So he was a very driven, sort of involved, engaged priest in the sense that he was the chaplain at Yale, I think, for a decade or so. He traveled the world speaking on social justice issues, burnt himself out over and over and over again in his ambitions and his drive, and ultimately retired from public life, in a sense, and became the chaplain at a large daybreak in Canada, which was a residential home for individuals with physical and cognitive disabilities, and spent the remainder of his years just serving the least of these, if you will. But what's interesting is that most of his most prolific and, I think people would say, spiritually and psychologically transformative writing happened while he was at large daybreak. He was forced to find the value in his human experience beyond the crowds and the accolades and the feedback. He's like, these people I'm serving every day, they don't care who I am. They don't care what I've accomplished. They care how present am I in this moment? How unconditional is my love? How steady is my care? That's what we're all really looking for anyway. So he really wrote some beautiful stuff in those years when he had sort of given up looking for the spotlight and just focused on being human with other human beings who are struggling as well. So
I am so glad you shared this, because this is a question that I have been grappling with since September of 2022. I can remember the exact time I wrote it down in my journal, because I just shared it with a client yesterday about how to be present and why it can serve us and why it might be ultimately the inner mission just for me is to learn to be as present as I can. That's where I felt the most flow, the most connected, the most loving and lovable is when I'm totally present. So I'm wondering, since you mentioned these mm-hmm. words, what is that question? How present am I in this moment? What might that question mean to you?
Oh man, how present am I in this moment? As soon as you said that question about presence, you talked about being in the flow. And I often have this image that comes to mind of being in the flow, that basically like we're in the flow of life and in the flow of existence. It's like a river, is how I picture it. But I think a lot of us spend a lot of our time trying to change the flow of the river. Like, I want to dam it up. I don't like how this is going. I don't want the river to flow like this. Let's just block it. Or I don't want the river to be flowing in this direction. So can I divert the river, onto a different path? And for me, the last couple of years, when I start to notice that energy, I remind myself that my job is just to be in the flow of the river. I do have a rudder. I can make small adjustments, right? There's a limb up there. I want to get around that limb. But to ultimately trust where the flow is headed and to participate in it by being present rather than feeling like I have to be doing something to it. And honestly, I can say, I guess I get a little emotional thinking about this. It's been the best couple years of my life. And I'm increasingly trusting where the river takes us, if you will. And so there's a sort of self-reinforcing cycle that happens there, I guess, when you're present and can trust the flow and look back and go, that was worth trusting, and keep doing it and keep being present. So that's definitely a big focus for me right now.
Yeah. What comes up for me in this question is the inverse relationship between being completely in control and being the architect of everything that is perfect the exact way that I want versus the flow, which is, I say, the emotional intelligence level of letting things flow through you rather than happening to you or for you. They all flow through you. That's the way I equate it. Example, I'm with a couple of mutual friends of ours, Ali and Wagner and Levesque, and a couple of the guys in my band, Nick and Sprang, where we went camping recently. I've never been camping before my entire life, by the way. And these are very experienced outdoor people.
Yeah, to put it mildly. Yeah, exactly. Sure.
So they have all this equipment, and we go and we hike, and I'm all up for the exercise. I love a good exercise. I feel I can hang in exercise situations. I didn't know what to do. Totally fish out of water, though, when it came to the camping part of it. So we go to the edge of North Carolina, Tennessee, to Bryson City, and we're going to the Great Smoky Mountains to go on just a one-night camping. And the weather forecast is abysmal for camping. It's not an ideal thing if you're a experienced camper. It was 45 degrees. It was pouring down rain, hard, heavy rain, probably 50 to 70% of the time. And this is maybe not the ideal way for some people. And my mindset was, I wouldn't have it any other way. This is the most amazing experience. I absolutely loved it. Rather than try to control it and do it at a perfect time with the perfect weather,
right.
And we leaned into this, and it was the most amazing experience, and everything flowed through us.
It reminds me of, it was our 20th wedding anniversary, which would have been a few years ago. We had end of October, booked a trip to Kauai, my wife and I. She loves sunshine, especially in north central Illinois in the late fall. Likes to get to warm, sunny places. So we get closer and closer to the trip, and the weather forecast for Kauai is like terrible. It's not going to be a nice trip. And I watch myself start to go into control mode. Well, okay, maybe we could fly to Kauai and then we can rent a plane, hop over to Maui and get a hotel there and then get back for our flight home. And I start to go into control mode and I tell my wife about this. And she says, I don't care what the weather is. I just want you to be present with me. If you're present with me, it doesn't matter what the sky's doing. It's like, what a good affirmation of that. And I think, I mean, that's our kids for sure. They just want you to be present with them. They're not concerned that you're taking them on the most perfect trip of all time. If it's the most perfect trip of all time, but you're frustrated and scattered and it's not perfect for them. So I think that's what our people want, is just our presence. I think that's what life wants from us, is our presence. I have notoriously been pretty terrible at that. I don't call myself a control freak. I call myself a control sneak. I have all sorts of sneaky ways of
Classic sneak. I love it.
I'm a control sneak. Yeah. Classic. I actually was called out on this at a Front Row Dads retreat. My ask was, I'd pick my middle schooler up from school. I ask about her day and like, she just shuts down, and I got drilled on it. And finally, like what was revealed was that I asked that question with a couple of agendas. And one of the agendas is I want her to know her dad's interested. so that in 30 years, when she goes to a therapist, she can't blame me for everything, basically. Like, and so I'm like literally trying, it's a control sneak. I'm trying to insert into her mind with a question at the end of the day that her dad is interested so that she'll be happy with me. That's very controlling, trying to control her inner experience. The other one is I want to know if something went wrong with her day so I can fix it before it devolves into some sort of unhealthy anxiety or depression, which is also me wanting to be in control. It's loving, but I can't control that. Well, the guy said, what if you just asked her if there's anything she wants to tell you about her day? Put her in control of it, right? It's like, that's a great idea. So I get home, I literally on the way home from the airport, this was from Austin a couple of years ago, I picked her up at school and I said, hey, sweetie, is there anything you want to tell me about your day? And she looks at me sideways, like, this is different. Goes, no. I'm like, okay. She's like testing me out to see if I'm really going to let her just stay with that, like be in control of it, right? And you know, sure enough, 30 seconds, a minute later, she starts to tell me all sorts of things about her day. Now the temptation, because I'm such a control sneak, is to be like, ooh, now I found the way to get her to talk.
Ooh, you put a voice to it. Thank you for saying that. Okay, good, good.
Yeah, so I'll just ask her that question and I'll get her to talk. So really it's not about having a certain kind of question. It's about showing up to that moment aware of that urge to be a control sneak and just a lot. And again, sort of participating, being present to, being in the flow of where she's at for the day. And it always goes better, even though it may not go the way I want it to.
I want to come back to control mode in a second, because you said it's something that you have an opportunity to continue to work on. Before we get to that, though, I want to ask a quick question. Did you come up with this control sneak, or is that something that you've heard somewhere else?
That's me. That's mine.
Okay. So if I wrote a book, I'm not a control freak, 10 ways I'm showing up as a control sneak, would that be plagiarism? Would that be, I don't want to steal your idea. I love the idea.
Well, let's just see who can write it first. And then and maybe we'll slap each other's names on it or something. Yeah, no, that is a label that I came up with. So most mammals on the planet have basically two ways of dealing with an external threat, fight or flight. I call it hiding or fighting. The Unhiding of Elijah Campbell is about the hiding side of that. Human beings have evolved a third way of dealing with an external threat, which is to try to control it. We've developed the capacity to use our frontal lobe to like plan, organize, manipulate, influence, all those things. And it's part of what makes us essentially human. And it's a wonderful thing. I mean, look at what we've accomplished as human beings with it. But when we're sort of sneakily using it in our relationships to control our people, when we're using it in spaces in our life where really, it's sort of an illusion that we have control over it, but we're still trying to control sneak it. You know, I think that's where we want to be aware of it and just sort of set it aside and be present.
I love the question. Is there anything you want to tell me about your day? Not to be a control sneak, to be totally present and open to offering them the control. So I love that. Before that, you mentioned when you go into control mode, since you're aware of you might be in control mode from time to time. What do you do when you catch yourself in control mode? Mm. What's your process for that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, man. The internal process on that would be, what am I afraid of? Because if I'm trying to control something, it means there's an experience that afraid may be too strong of a word. You could say there's an experience I'm attached to having right now, and there's an experience I'm resisting having right now. And so you can ask that question of yourself. So your urge to control it is to say, I want this to happen and I don't want this to happen. And then we can ask why. What's the pain point I'm trying to avoid? What's the pleasure I'm trying to seek? So we can start to play with those polarities of attaching to pleasure, resisting pain. What am I controlling here to go in one direction and not the other? So I think that's a piece of it. When we're with our people, I think it can be really powerful. I mean, if you can recognize your control sneak and just name it out loud. I mean, that isn't one of the most open-hearted things you can do. Classic example, we're like 3 hours from leaving for a family weekend last September. I laid out a bunch of money and planning to take my family down to a Penn State, Illinois football game, spend the weekend. And my secret control sneak agenda was for my 16-year-old to fall in love with the University of Illinois, my alma mater. So he'll want to go there. And so I can go down and like recreate my own college experience with him vicariously. Well, leading up to the weekend, he's stiff-arming me. I don't want to go. Why do we have to go? And I'm doing the, oh, you ungrateful little, all the time energy I put into this. Like, you can't even like go do this. And I'm on a call with my coach just a couple hours before it. He says, well, what's your agenda? Like, what's your main agenda for the weekend? And I hadn't even thought about this yet. I'm like, I want him to fall in love with the U of I. What he said was, you can either have an agenda or you can connect, but you can't have both. You can either have an agenda or you can connect, but you can't have both. So if you want to be connected with Quinn this weekend, you probably just need to let go of that agenda. And so I did, and I told him, you know what he said to me? He said, Dad, the reason I don't want to go is that I'm loving high school so much, I don't want to think about it coming to an end already. I'm like, oh, I could, yes, yes, ignore this weekend. Love, be present to your life. Don't be thinking about your future 3 years from now. Yes, like there was this incredible moment of connection that as soon as I was able to sort of name the agenda and get it out of the way, we could have. I think internally, it's sort of, it's taken the barometer of what's the pleasure I'm attaching to, what's the pain I'm resisting. And then externally with our people, it's being vulnerable if we can about what we're seeing.
Yeah. Awesome. I'm going to share with you a couple of things that are just going through my head. Number one, I can appreciate the Canvas Pop reference. I'm going to get those for my book.
There you go.
Number two, control freak versus control sneak. Clever. I absolutely love it. And should I write that book first, which I'm not going to, but should I will put on the cover to the control sneak who empowered this to happen or something. I'm kidding, of course. But yeah, this has been really, really cool to jam with you on this stuff.
Yeah, man. Matt, I hope that those listening are as inspired as you by that concept of control sneak. I hope people use it freely. Again, what we're here to do is make an impact, right?
And right.
To be walking around going, huh, what's my agenda for this conversation, this experience, this event? And what would it look like to just show up and connect instead and be present? I think that would probably level up life for all of us. So may it spread.
Yeah. Simplify our love. Simplify it. Love it. Well, I say, let's let it be. I really enjoy just always connecting with you, Kelly. Look forward to seeing you here in a couple of weeks.
I would say I look forward to having a beer with you, but of course we won't. We'll have a seltzer together.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Awesome.
And then A1. All right. Sounds good, man.
All right, brother. Great to see you today.
Thank you.